My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing to prove.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. This is Heather, and today's episode is going to be something just a tiny bit different. Most of you know Randy from Mormon Expression and also from his appearance on Mormon Stories. He has brought his father on to share his father's story about growing up Mormon and his life as a Mormon, as well as what it means to have apostate children and maintaining a good relationship with your apostate children. So I think I'll go ahead and turn this over to Randy and his dad to have this conversation. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Heather. Hi, Dad.
Hi. Hi, son.
Well, like Heather said, some of you may recognize my voice. Some of you, a lot of you probably don't, but my background is I grew up in the church, was very devout, and just a few years ago, I left the church. If you wanna, I'm sure none of you do, but if you wanna get the full story, it's the 6.5-hour podcast on Mormon Stories, understanding atheism after Mormonism. So currently, I prefer the term naturalist, but atheist is a more familiar term to most people. And I come from a family of 7 kids, and my father has agreed, who is to be interviewed by me, with Heather assisting, to talk about how he has been such a shining example to me of a loving, unconditional loving father throughout this process. And I'm not the only child that has left the church. My father currently, he's recently released from the bishopric in his local ward. But he has for the last 10 years, taught early morning seminary in Southern California and is in the ward I grew up in. He's still in the same ward. He's, served in many bishoprics on the high council, ward mission leader, young men's president. He's basically done the rounds. And, but his passion is teaching, seminary. He also teaches one class a week at the University of Southern California, LDS Institute. And is, a true believing Mormon in every sense of the word. And so what I'd like to do is, start off by, getting a background, Dad, on your history with the church. First, let's start, with your heritage as it pertains to Mormonism, and not only Mormonism, but you do have kind of an interesting family tree in religion. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your heritage, Dad?
Okay. Well, I was born in Los Angeles back in 1939. My dad was an inactive member of the church. He was born in Salt Lake, raised in Ogden, is one of 7 children, 2 of whom died before they reached the age of 4. Grandpa Snyder never supported the family. In fact, he was an alcoholic who died of a heart attack on the sidewalk of Skid Row in Ogden, which was 25th Street in those days. When my dad was 12, he was buried in a pauper's grave in the Ogden City Cemetery. Granny, as we call Grandma Snyder, she supported her family as best she could as a housekeeper, and the church also helped her out. That's what my dad always said. In the minds of Granny's descendants, she was a saint and lived until she was exactly 100 years old, 100 years and 10 days. As for my mother, she was of no particular religion that I'm aware of. She died at the age of 32 when I was 6. She had 2 brothers, neither of whom were married. My grandpa Phelps was a painter who spent his last years in a sanitarium in Phoenix. I was always told he was an alcoholic like Grandpa Snyder. And Grandma Phelps was a spiritualist, at least I think she was, because I vividly remember her more than once trying to teach me how to use a Ouija board. And I was the only grandchild that Grandpa and Grandma Phelps ever had. That's the beginning. You want more?
Okay. So your mother was an unaffiliated Christian.
I don't know if she was even Christian, but she respected Christianity because she always let me go to church with a neighbor girl at the Methodist church.
Okay. Well, you were born and raised, or born initially and initially raised in South Central LA. It's a little different in the early 40s back then. But your mother died when you were six, and how did that change the course of your life?
Well, after the death of my mom, Dad moved to Ogden, and we eventually settled in with Granny, Grandma Snyder. And we lived in West Ogden for 3 years with her. Now, at that time, I occasionally attended church, not often, but often enough to get baptized. Now, neither Granny or my dad attended church, but apparently we had good ward teachers. And then when I was 10 years old, my aunt's husband was killed in an auto accident, and my aunt faced the dilemma of how to support and care for her kids. She had a job, but no one to watch them. The problem was solved with Granny, Dad, and I moving in with her. And at the time, I was in fifth grade. My cousins were in fourth and first grades, respectively. The arrangement worked well for the 5 years that we lived together. They were really like a brother and sister to me. Then when I was 14, my dad remarried, and we moved into our home on the other side of town. Now, are you interested in my activity in the church?
Yeah, so you've mentioned to me before, you know, all the years that we've talked, you know, we've always had a pretty special relationship, and you've always loved sharing your history with me. So talk about kind of the seminal moments in your childhood, because, I mean, obviously you were raised by a father who had nothing to do with the church, really. I believe you told me he was a deacon, and that was the extent of it, and hadn't been to church probably most of his life. And your mother wasn't Mormon, and she died when you were young. So how is it that you stayed active? What were the seminal moments you like to talk about that kind of kept you meandering somewhat along this path of Mormonism?
Well, after, when we get to it, but anyways, after your mom passed away, it was a moment of real introspection, and I really wondered, how the hell did I get to where I am right now?
That's some salty and language for a Mormon.
My dad taught me well. anyways, I went back and I just reconstructed my life. And there were really 9 people who were kind of like rocks in a creek. And you, every time you take a step, you step on a rock, not realizing you're being supported by that. I mean, there was a Sunday school teacher. Somehow or other, I ended up going to church, and I was by myself. And this was in about the fifth, sixth grade. And I had a Sunday school teacher that I adored, and she asked for volunteers for 2.5-minute talks, which is what they did in those days. And I raised my hand to please her. And she wouldn't let me fail. She typed out my talk, made me memorize it, and I was a hit. And she was a sweetheart. She followed me until she died right after I went on my mission. Then there was a scoutmaster who was a mentor, who was just a super guy. And I was a pallbearer at his funeral. And a counselor and a bishopric who showed an interest in all of the Aaronic priesthood youth, took us to the Weber gym and swimming and all that sort of stuff. And then when my dad got married, we moved, and I thought, I don't need to go to church. I can be really good by just, you know, without going to church. In other words, I was shy, bashful, didn't want to risk being rejected and all that sort of stuff. Then I had a teacher's quorum advisor who just would not let me not go to church. He would call every morning, and I would be by the telephone so that it wouldn't wake my mom and dad. Then I'd be ready to go so we wouldn't have a discussion. I'd just run out to the car. Well, that got me started. And then a bishop who was my high school typing teacher and my home teaching companion, an Explore advisor who I adored, next door neighbor who gave me employment while I was going to college anytime I needed it, another neighbor who took us hunting and played basketball with us, and then the bishop who convinced me that I should go on a mission. They all just kind of held me in place until good Bishop Goff, talked to me about going on a mission, and it made all the difference.
So it wasn't just kind of keeping you in place. They also fulfilled kind of a role in your kind of filled a hole in your life, because your dad wasn't exactly the most attentive and involved father in the world. And it seems to me, I mean, is this a fair characterization? The church kind of acted almost like a surrogate parent in some way.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, but don't forget, my dad really cared, and he somehow left within me a desire to please him. And when I did things involving church, he was happy. He was thrilled. I mean, he came from a different generation, a different lifestyle, but I just always seemed to want to please him, and going to church actually pleased him.
Okay. So let's fast forward a little bit. You didn't go on a mission right when you turned 19. So let's talk about that stretch from when you graduated from high school to when you went on a mission.
Well, in those days, you went on a mission when you're 20, not 19.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then when between high school and college, I went to Weber College for 2 years, and I wasn't doing that well. I got about a 2.5, 2.6 in engineering. Nothing spectacular, but good enough to get into the University of Utah. And so I went there for 1 year, and I bombed. I ended up on the dean's team on scholastic probation. I ended up with a 1.8 in the year that I went to the University of Utah. And everybody thought, oh, he's going to college. What a terrific thing. And I was on the verge of flunking out.
You wouldn't have even been eligible to play football.
Unfortunately, that was not a problem.
So your life is kind of floundering. And at this point, this is when is a Bishop Goff?
Mm-hmm.
Bishop Goff got a hold of you.
Yep, he actually called me aside just before my 20th birthday, and I was already set to go to University of Utah, and it involved a summer camp, and so I had every excuse in the book to not go, and he had every reason to, I mean, for every excuse I gave, he gave a better reason to go, and so my coup de grace was going to be, well, my folks are going to have to, support me. And I'll be darned if he didn't come over and convince them that I should go too. And he and my dad even said he'd work a second job if he had to support me. So the following year, after my crummy year at University of Utah, then I went on my mission.
Tell us about your mission experience. You're 21 now, and you're called to the Mexico City, Mexico mission. So tell us about that experience.
Okay, it was the Mexican mission. It took about two-thirds of Mexico at that time.
There was only this is 1960, so this is a little different world than the mission field I entered.
But anyways, when I went on my mission, my testimony was really mostly based on the trust of those that I respected in the church. I believed it was true, but I wanted to know it was true. And I'd seen others come back, and they just seemed to be older than the 2 to 2.5 years in age. And each of them had grown spiritually in a way that I really wanted to experience. So anyways, when I arrived in Mexico, I was scared to death. I'll never forget the plane coming down, 6 o'clock in the morning. And then you see the cars moving. Then you see the people moving. Then all of a sudden, everybody's speaking Spanish. And I didn't know whether I was flying a bonfire, building a kite when I got there. And so, anyways, once I got assigned to a city called Poza Rica, Veracruz, I began to study the lessons, the language, Book of Mormon. But the moment, the real seminal moment in my whole life, much less my mission, was about 4 months into it. And I was lying on my cot one morning in Poza Rica, reading the Book of Mormon, when I felt the Spirit so strongly bear witness that what I was reading was the Word of God. There was absolutely no doubt in my mind. It wasn't a wish that was being fulfilled. It was something happening. And it was one of the rare moments when there was just, to me, absolutely no doubt. And from that moment, I have never doubted the truthfulness of the restored gospel. And I went on to have really a pretty good movement. There were times early on when I was like Charlie Brown up against the fence in the backyard, and we had one, and I was out there like him thinking, did I make the right decision? But no, I don't want to go back because I'll be too embarrassed to face all the people. So I stuck it out until I got that testimony, and then I had a terrific mission thereafter.
Let's talk about you coming home from your mission and meeting Mom.
Okay. I don't know whether I mentioned, but when I was...
And also, you know, feel free to give a little bit of kind of a paint a picture of the kind of person Mom was and so forth.
Well, she was a farm girl from far west Utah, and my stepmother knew her sister-in-law, and the two of them conspired to get us to go on a blind date as soon as I got home from my mission. So we, 1 week after I got home, we were lined up and we went out. And it was a disaster in my mind. We double dated with her brother and sister-in-law. And I was so out of it. I didn't know popular music. I really wanted to speak Spanish. Hadn't seen any of the movies in the last 2 years. Everything was just 2 years out of whack. And after about 5 minutes of talking about my mission, I just felt like a spectator at a tennis match looking back and forth as everyone else talked. But as luck would have it, my stepmom interceded again and found out that the farm girl from far west was actually impressed with me. And I definitely was impressed with her, so I called her up and took her to my missionary homecoming talk at sacrament meeting the next night. And this time I did impress her. Long story short, I proposed after 1 month and we were married 6 months later.
Your classic Mormon courtship.
Hey, when you find a needle in the haystack after one handful of hay, you don't throw it back because you're not supposed to find it.
I guess I'll just give a little bit of background. Mom grew up what I would call a bit of a sheltered childhood. She was a sweet, wonderful person, hardworking. I always liked the way I like to kind of paint her, how sheltered she was. Soon after you guys got married, you moved from Ogden to Los Angeles. And the very first time she took your first baby, Jimmy, to the doctor, he was black. and mom's initial reaction, it was just a natural reaction, was she didn't want the black guy to touch her baby. And of course, she changed after a while, but pretty quickly. And she was by no means racist. But that's, you know, when you have never seen a black person pretty much your whole life, that's pretty sheltered. She grew up in Far West, which is a farming community outside of Ogden. And she very much believed, had a testimony in the church with all of her heart. I mean, it was, every fiber of her being kind of testimony. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So you guys, you finish college and you get your degree. You definitely improved on that 1.8. Post-mission GPA was night and day compared to your pre-mission GPA. And you took a job with LA County in Southern California. So I guess at this point, I'd kind of like to get a flavor of what it was like and some of your experiences raising 7 kids in Southern California with mom.
Well, it indeed was a challenge. I mean, we just arbitrarily decided to have 6 children, but ended up with the 7th. And your mom was the traditional stay-at-home mom, but she supplemented my income by sewing many of the clothes worn by the family and in any other way that she could come up with to reduce our family expenses. She was really, really creative. It's hard to explain how creative she was, but she just was that kind of person. And there were times when, well, to give you an example of her faith, there were times when I really didn't know how we would meet all of our family expenses. In the 70s, it was tough. It was double-digit inflation and single-digit pay raises. And many a time I would be sitting at the desk in our office trying to balance the budget only to get discouraged about how our expenses just always seemed to exceed the income. And occasionally your mom would pop in and ask how it was going. And if I ever complained that I was having trouble balancing the budget, she would always say, just be sure to pay our tithing. I did, and somehow we seemed to get by. Now, we raised all of you kids in the church, and there was never really a discussion about whether we were going to go to church. We just went. We even had our pew, fifth row back on the left side, and a system to minimize the noise that always comes from a large family like ours in sacrament meetings. It was never really a problem with you kids attending church. You and your 2 brothers advanced in the Aaronic priesthood right on schedule, and all 3 of you served honorable missions.
One thing I do remember was that we went to church no matter what, no matter where. I remember being in a log cabin on vacation in Island Park, Idaho, and we found a church. That's one thing I definitely remember, was we always went to church. There's actually one thing that was kind of interesting in my marriage, is that when I married my wife, her family was a little bit more lax on that. If they were outside of their ward boundaries visiting relatives, it was a day off of church on a Sunday. Where we, you know, if we were in Siberia, we would have found a church. And there's definitely a devout background. I guess I could chime in a little bit on what it was like to be a child of Jim and Betsy Snyder. Mom was just very emotional and passionate about her faith. You were kind of a nice balance in that you definitely believed. You definitely had a testimony. You were faithful. You served in many different callings. But you also had a little bit more patience. You seemed to have a little bit, You had a different way of going about parenting. It's one of the things I still try to model as a father now, is you always built the relationship with your kids on trust. And we were given trust initially, but if we violated that trust, then you'd have to earn it back. Whereas mom wanted to be more strict. Did you take your cues from Mormonism with this style, or was this just something that came naturally to you?
I think it came naturally, but to contrast your mom's style with my style, I think it really was a nice balance. She was the one that played the role of the hammer, the one who would discipline. And there was a few times, not a whole lot, where I wanted to come down and with a harsh punishment, and she would stick up for you. If any time she stuck up for you, I gave in because I thought maybe I am being too strict, but she really was the strict one. But it was a nice balance. It was a nice balance, I think, where, you know, there were times when my style was what was needed, and there were times when her style was what was needed.
Yeah, and I can attest as one of your children that we grew up in a pretty healthy atmosphere, pretty much. I guess my experience is most likely different from maybe what it was like to be a girl in the family. I don't know. But it was definitely a healthy atmosphere to grow up in. There wasn't a lot of baggage that I carry from my childhood at all. Excuse me, at all. So talking about your two different parenting styles, I think that's a good segue into getting into the meat of what this podcast is about. Let's talk about, because I remember this moment in my childhood. It was this really distinct thought that I had. It was like this moment of pride. I can't even remember where I was in the chapel. I was just outside the chapel in the foyer. And I remember looking at our family and hearing, we had just heard some stories of other families whose kids were struggling with drinking or getting pregnant or leaving the church. And I remember thinking, wow, we got the perfect Mormon family. We're all in the church and it's going to stay that way. So this couldn't have been too long before the first fall of grace in our family. So why don't you talk about the first experience you had with a child struggling with the church?
Well, that would have to be with your sister when she left the church. And it wasn't because she lost her testimony, but rather she fell in love with a boy who didn't share her beliefs or standards. She had a choice, and she chose him and subsequently left the church. It was difficult. It was difficult on both your mom and me. It was the first time we had any crack in the armor, so to speak. But we adjusted to her decision, and your mom was really pretty good about it once they got married. And then we had a good relationship thereafter, and I still have a real good relationship with both of them.
There's a couple of points I want to make about her. Number one, mom was a little harsher, especially when pregnant at BYU and had to come home, and mom was kind of embarrassed about it. And this sister got disfellowshipped. Well, she had a boyfriend that was pretty outspoken and not very well disposed to the church. But, and I'm not even sure you know this, but on mom's deathbed, when she had her moment with his sister, she apologized for the way she treated her. And so mom did not handle that situation initially very well, but in the end, I think she acknowledged that and made good with her. And that meant a ton to the sister. Any thoughts about that?
I was not aware of that, but I do know that you are right. When we found out that she was pregnant, she decided, or we decided, I don't even remember who made the decision, that she was just going to stay at home. She got a job, but she was not going to go to church, not going to expose herself until after the baby was born. Because there was actually still a decision that had to be made. Was she going to keep the baby or give it up? Were they going to get married or not? Her now husband didn't make that decision until after the baby was born, and that created a lot of pressure, a lot of stress on everybody except him. And then when he finally decided to marry your sister after the baby was born, then everybody settled down because now we knew what everybody was going to be doing. But at one point in that whole process, I came to the realization, and then your mom and I talked about it, where we really did screw up. We were very concerned about our own reputation, and I'm afraid to some degree at the expense of your sister. And we backed up and we tried to make good, but there was a time when your sister didn't know whether we loved her. And we always did, but I'm afraid we did take it wrong. We did handle it poorly in the beginning, and then worked as hard as we could once things got settled to make it good. And she's had two sons, and both of them I helped her husband with Little League. I mean, about 5 years of Little League, where I was a coach, scorekeeper, you name it.
So yeah, definitely. The relationship you have with this sister and even her husband is pretty good. And yeah. It's definitely ended okay. I know. I'm sure that there's still that disappointment that she's not in the church and her kids aren't raised in the church. But the relationship did survive pretty well, I think.
Mm-hmm. It has. It really has.
Let's move on to the next child that disaffected, Jimmy.
Okay, now his was, for both of us, much more difficult to deal with. You know, he'd served an honorable mission, and then while attending BYU, I don't know why BYU is the catalyst here, or at least the location, he lost his testimony. I know we put a lot of thought into that final decision, but this was still more difficult for us than it had been with your sister, because he was really rejecting what we had so strongly believed in. And somehow your mom took it more personally. It was especially difficult for her. And
yeah.
I
remember you once saying that my sister left was not as painful for you because you felt like, she was kind of seduced away by a charismatic young man who has used that charisma to be very successful in the business world, my dad. But that was something that was, you felt like there was a little bit less of a direct rejection. But Jimmy, like, flat out rejected the worldview that you guys presented for him as the worldview that you wanted for him. And I can still remember that mom had a hard time being in the same room with Jimmy once she found out without crying. Is that true?
Well, it was just unfortunate. Your mom had one weakness, and that is if she got emotional, she couldn't control it. And it bugged her. She worked on that and worked on it, but it didn't matter. And so whenever Jimmy was on the phone, she couldn't talk to him because she would lose it. And he, you know, it was kind of hard to understand from his perspective.
What was it like for you? Because in some ways, I feel like you were kind of in the middle. Like you maybe could understand better maybe where Jimmy was coming from. Maybe you couldn't. Maybe I'm just reading into it too much. And you're kind of in between this woman with this very fervent, basically visceral testimony. Yours is definitely an internal testimony, but you also, you love to get into farms and to ancient research. And it's also intellectual for you to a much greater degree than mom. So I think that positioned you kind of in between. Did you feel sometimes you were kind of a middle ground, like a mediator between the two?
A lot. It was just an awkward thing to happen. And I think that probably one thing that kind of got your mom off of it a little bit is when she got ill. she suddenly had something else she had to focus on. But all I remember is that before she died, she wanted so badly to see him. And he was getting ready to fly from New York to come home, and she passed away while he was in the airport. She never did get that, but she did get to express her love on the phone for him.
What mechanisms or what tools did you use, if any, to cope with it, or did you not have any?
Well, I was going in both directions, trying to comfort your mom and trying to deal with Jimmy. Now, Jimmy wasn't trying to hurt anybody. And it certainly was his right to make that decision, but I was trying to comfort, but make him feel as comfortable as possible that he was making a decision that was his to make. And then your mom's illness came into the game, into play, and that kind of took our minds off of what Jimmy was doing, at least at that time.
I'll speak for Jimmy. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Heather.
Well, I just wanted to jump in with a quick question. I think it's the experience of a lot of people who, during their disaffection process, that their parents, I don't want to say accuse, but they make assumptions about things that must be going on in their lives or things they must be doing that are causing them to be deceived. Did you guys ever have those types of conversations or concerns about him? Or
No.
Did you accepted that these were conscious choices he was making?
I accepted they were conscious choices he was making, and I know he was wrestling with it. And up until, he didn't really leave the church, I don't think, until he went on to grad school at Vanderbilt. But I remember visiting him periodically, and right up until he left BYU, he was even the gospel doctrine teacher. So he was wrestling himself with what to do or how to handle it or whatever his problem was.
So it seemed evident that it wasn't any other influence in his life.
No, we didn't. We never suspected anything like that.
Okay.
You, because I remember when Jimmy left the church, I was a freshman in college, and it rocked my world. And I remember in the Book of Mormon, there's a passage about the wise and the learned who are ever learning but never come into a knowledge of the truth. And they think they are wise, but their knowledge profiteth them nothing, and they shall perish. Next to that scripture in the Book of Mormon, in my missionary scriptures, I wrote Jimmy and Heather. So Jimmy is a very, very intelligent person. He's on another level of intelligence than the rest of the family. He went on to go to a PhD program in philosophy. So you can probably guess that his going into philosophy and learning, reading, and he reads voraciously. And so a lot of times, a lot of knowledge, this is pretty, I mean, there's a correlation between education level and level of disbelief in America. knowledge can undercut the legs of religion a lot of the time. So, I mean, did you ever think Jimmy was too smart for his own good?
That thought passed through my mind.
Do you believe he relies too heavily upon the learning and thoughts of this world rather than his spiritual eyes, for lack of a better term?
Well, yeah, I would say that because of what won out. But again, that was his choice.
And you don't feel that you have to try to pressure him with parental-type pressure into changing that?
No, wouldn't do any good anyway.
Okay.
It just wouldn't.
And so you don't allow that, you accept that and don't allow that to be a factor in your relationship?
No, what I have done with both Randy and Jimmy is that just to leave it in a position of agreeing to disagree. And I don't like to get into religious discussions. It only creates tension and discomfort. And I like to deal with what we can agree with, which is our history together and doing what we do, going to USC football games, whatever it is that we can can do to share what we have of life.
Well, I think that's commendable. Okay, Randy, go ahead.
Okay, so let's move forward, because I think this is a really important part of where you are now with your faith, Dad, and the strength of your testimony in the church. Just give us a little taste of what it was like when Mom died, the last few days of her cancer, or at least the last. No, I don't know if you want to say, just pick up the story wherever you feel comfortable.
Well, first of all, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. She had a tumor that was growing in her ovaries. And we thought, we're led to believe that a simple operation could remove the tumor. And with your mom's faith, I never really had any doubts that her faith would prevail. And then after the operation, the doctors told us that it was much worse than expected. The cancer had spread throughout her abdomen. And it was very advanced. And I went home devastated. My faith had been seriously challenged. At the time, I was only 48. She was 46. And five of you kids were still at home. The youngest was only six. I didn't know how I'd survive without your mom. I was too young to retire. No grandparents lived close by that could help. And I was shook up. Well, as it turned out, when we went back in and they had a chance to check the results of the biopsy, they learned that your mom did have a life-threatening form of cancer, but it was a rare, slow-growing cancer that was not invasive. And it just would grow at a very slow rate. And what we initially thought would be she'd have 6 months to live, turned out to be 8 years. Now, as you know, she fought her cancer with a passion. She tried homeopathic medicine. That didn't work. We went to Washington, D.C. to visit a specialist, and that didn't work. She even went down to southern Mexico to visit a healer. That didn't work. She was willing to try really almost anything, and nothing worked. And she passed away in 1996 at the age of 54. But it was a time when your mom and I were bonded more than any other time in our 33 years of marriage. Our love became celestial. In fact, in the last 10 days of her life when she was in hospice, they were the best 10 days of our marriage. We talked about life after death. She planned her own funeral. We even talked about what she expected me to do after she passed away. It was a very special time, and I wouldn't trade it for any experience in life. And one thought that's kind of permeated my thought process, we all die. There's no getting around that, but the first death is the tough one when you're in a good marriage. First death is separation. Second death is reunion. So my challenge for the rest of my mortal life is to stay worthy enough to be with her on the other side of the veil. And I fully expect to be there when it's my time to pass through the veil, because she promised that she would. So that's how that went.
So, thank you. I mean, that's exactly what I was looking for. That's definitely one of the most spiritual, would you say that? I mean, that's probably the most spiritual experience you've been through.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, I guess that's a really stupid thing to, obvious thing to
no,
say.
No, but really, I mean, when you're in it, I mean, when you're in a situation where, say, in our situation, your mom was dying. She had an operation about halfway through. That was another one of the things we tried. and the results were bad. But all of her friends called up to say, well, how's Betsy doing? How was the operation? And I had to tell them the bad news. Well, then there's this silence. And I thought, my gosh, I've got to help them comfort me. And that was an interesting experience. And I did. And the whole experience was a very special thing to go through, to be part of it, and then to be able to step aside whenever possible and just take a look at what was happening. And you know, as it was. But it was a very special, very special experience. And I'll just never forget that. Never forget that, those last 10 days.
That's actually kind of funny, because one thing I learned about mom dying, I was 21 at the time when she died. There's nothing to say to people when they've lost a loved one, so don't even try. Just the only thing I can say to people is just express your love and your sorrow, and just leave it at that, because there's nothing you can say.
That is so true.
So let's fast forward a little bit. You actually remarried. You fell in love faster than you remarried, because you wanted my little brother to get home from his mission to the Philippines before you got married. But you married the lady down the street who mom had actually helped introduce to the church, ironically. Her kids were my friends. They then became my siblings, step siblings. So that was kind of weird. Of course, we were all adults, so it didn't really matter. But you married the lady down the street. Is it okay to use her name, Dan?
Yeah, that's okay.
You married Joan. She's from here, Missouri, originally, or her family is, and she was raised RLDS. And then she converted to Mormonism after she met mom. But I would characterize Joan not as a TBM, not as a true believing Mormon, but as kind of a universalist Mormon. Very accepting of other Christian faiths, not so big on the one and only true church, but she definitely believes strongly in God and Jesus. Is that a fair characterization of Joan?
Yeah, I think so.
I guess we'll find out when she responds.
Yeah, she wants to listen to this, you know.
Of course. So several years goes by after mom's death in 1996, and it looks like, you know, all your kids are adults. The four girls, you know, one of the older sisters kind of wavered a little bit after her divorce, but then she remarried a devout Mormon. So essentially, the other three sisters married happily, active in the church. I was, you know, serving a scoutmaster and young men's, and you know, you got another, my little brother, who's actually in the bishopric of the Kirtland, Ohio ward, which is kind of cool. I live in Zion, and he lives in Kirtland. Well, not in Kirtland, but he's in the Kirtland ward. So in your mind, did you feel like, okay, we're set, the damage has been done? At this point, do you know what I'm talking about?
What do you mean, the damage?
Meaning you've lost as many kids as you're probably going to lose to apostasy.
Yeah. I actually did. I mean, I go down the, you know, I would have my periodic prayers and, you know, take a temperature of all my kids, at least as I perceived them. Yes, I did. I thought I was, I won't say home free, but that was it.
So let's fast forward, 1996. To 2009, maybe the beginning of 2010. Well, actually, let's go to the summer of 2009. I had just real quickly, this podcast isn't about my disaffection, but I had just revealed to my wife on our 12th anniversary in Cabo that I didn't believe anymore. And she gave me an ultimatum. She said, you either go home. I was a high priest group leader at the time. She told me, when we get home, you either have to talk to the bishop or talk to your dad. I'm not a fan of ultimatums, but I had kind of rocked her world. So I chose you, and we had our little special. I was extremely nervous to talk to you. I think I was almost threw up before we met at, I think it was Paradise, that sandwich shop.
Right.
In Phoenix. And so walk me through your experience of Paradise Cafe.
Well, I have to admit that I was surprised that you came to me and admitted that you were struggling. My biggest disappointment was not realizing how serious it was, at least from my perspective. I don't know if I could have made a difference, but I wish I would have tried harder. I also wish I would have paid better attention to the signs that were there also, because they were when I went back and checked it out. But I didn't realize that in your swing from believer to non-believer, you were closer to being a non-believer. I thought that you were at the questioning stage.
And there was a strategy to that. I didn't want to hit you with a blindside punch. I wanted to kind of give you a couple of jabs to get your attention, then hit you with a couple of crosses that, you know, wouldn't devastate you.
SeaWorld.
I do remember seeing the pain on your face after I listed all my problems with the church history and with the racism in the history of the church, especially Brigham Young, who became a very central focal point of my disaffection. Seeing the pain in your face as I kept listing all these problems with the Book of Abraham and the anachronisms in the Book of Mormon and all that stuff. After I saw the pain, I kind of pulled back a little bit on the reins and I gave you a line that I stole from someone else, that, you know, I'm fighting for my faith. If this wasn't so important to me, I wouldn't be fighting so hard. But the reality was I was already gone, mentally. And I just wanted to let you in and kind of feel you out for how you would react. You reacted very admirably, but it was definitely the pain was on your face.
Well, it is painful.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, you, it's your life. You have to live it. And I have to back off and let that happen. And you know, for much of my life, you know, you talked about my dad not being a total supporter and all that sort of stuff. He could be sometimes quite thoughtless. And I just kind of learned to suck it in when things didn't go like I thought that they would, like the Christmas that he forgot to buy any Christmas presents for his only son.
Yeah.
And you know, things like that. It just was the way he was, and I loved him notwithstanding. But I had learned to deal in disappointment, and yours was one of those, and I just kind of suck it in, and you know, and
right.
And learned how to deal with it.
So we parted ways. You were not as aware of how far gone I was as far as believing in the church. We fast forward 6 months, maybe. So we're at the beginning of 2010. I was ready to leave the church. Jen had her struggle, my wife, 5 month wrestle with it, and finally came to the conclusion, the same thing as me. I kind of wanted to stay in the church, but she said, no, if we don't believe, we're not going. We're not going to be hypocrites. So she kind of pulled me out of the church. But now it was like one of my sisters, one of the strongest believing sisters is in my ward, so I can't leave the church without the family knowing. So now it's time for the big reveal in the beginning of 2010. And I remember two of the believing sisters calling me before I was to meet with you and really let you know what was going on. They were so worried that they insisted that I drive you back to where you were staying in Phoenix because they thought you might get in a car accident after I revealed that to you.
That was why.
That's why I picked you up and drove you back. I was shocked because when we went to IHOP, we always pick the nicest restaurants for these big occasions. And I had a strategic plan to reveal to you, and I went one by one with some of the problems of the church, and I would always end it, would you see how this could be a problem for me? And you said, yes, it's reasonable. And then I'd bring up another point. I said, Dad, you see how this could be a problem for me? Finally, after the third one, you're like, what's your point? What are you getting at? Dad, we've left the church. I don't believe anymore. Jen doesn't believe anymore. And I expected something, but I got nothing. So please tell me what was going through your head during this IHOP breakfast.
To be honest, I don't remember right now. I don't. Through all this process, there's how did I cope with it? Do you want to hear how I've coped with it?
That's exactly what I want to hear. I know that you've taken some solace in some doctrine preached by Bob Millett, who was my DNC instructor at BYU, by the way. He was the dean of religion at BYU for a long time. So why don't you share with us? At the beginning of this podcast, I had meant to include my introduction, and I forgot to. I'm hoping that this podcast can be something that disaffected apostates, if you want to call them that, children can, or anyone, any apostates can send loved ones to as kind of like an example of how to handle this successfully. And I would characterize you as someone who's handled it very successfully. So why don't you share with us some of your coping mechanisms that you find within the doctrines of the church?
Well, okay, a few years ago I came across a talk by Robert Millett, and it was a 1995 talk that he gave to BYU religious education faculty, and it's included in the selected writings of Robert L. Millett. That's where I found it. The talk quotes several brethren, including Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, Orson Wifney, Boyd K. Packer, and just to lift a couple of quotes from the article, there's a number of them. It said, when parents keep the covenants they have made at the altar of the temple, their children will be forever bound to them, end quote. And then a new quote, they, the wayward children, will have to pay their debt to justice. They will suffer for their sins and may tread a thorny path, but if it leads them at last to a loving and forgiving father's heart and home, the painful experience will not have been in vain. Now that article really made a big difference in my attitude toward what's happened in our family. And then more recently, while preparing a seminary lesson, I came across a quote from David O. McKay, which stated, next to the bestowal of life itself, the right to direct that life is God's greatest gift to man. Now, combine those quotes with the realization, I know that God loves us in a perfect way, and it's got to be a pain to him to see so many of his children go astray. Yet, as President McKay said, it's the right to direct that life that's God's greatest gift to man. So God has to put up with it, with so many of his children making what at least I would consider the wrong decisions. Now, Joan and I have a combined total of 11 children, all married, 21 grandchildren with two more on the way, and I can honestly say that I love all 44 other members of our family, all of them. I care for them, I pray for them, and when I get lonely for a grandchild, I'll call one of your sisters or stepsisters and arrange to kidnap a child just to be with that child and show the love that I can. I'm willing to assist any of them any way that I can and that's proper. And it just gives me a peek at how our Heavenly Father must feel about each and every one of his children, billions of them. And I think that he really does understand the pain that your mother and I have felt over, well, in you guys leaving the church. But the quotes from Brother Millett regarding the power of the sealing ordinance give me hope and help me better deal with the disaffection of you and your siblings from the church. And as a result of that and your willingness to not debate the issues we disagree on, it's allowed us to maintain a wonderful relationship. We just have to agree to disagree for a season, that's all.
Yeah, we definitely don't talk about Fox News too much.
Well, you know, you're right. We don't. Let's stick with the things that we really enjoy. That we have great memories. We have some absolutely wonderful memories from the past.
Yeah, we do. I mean, you and I have always had kind of, I'm one of seven kids, but you and I have always had kind of a special connection. And that was. And the other siblings know that, and they, you know, they even make jokes about it. But that was one of the things that I feared the most, was losing that special relationship I have with you by leaving the church. And you have definitely not disappointed me in that sense. And so I guess what you're drawing from as far as church doctrine is that if a man and a woman are true to their temple covenants, eventually their kids will come back, and you don't have to be alive to see it.
Exactly. That's my understanding. The article it's a pretty long article, and anyways, there's enough in it to give me hope, and to mitigate a lot of the anxiety that. I could feel under other circumstances.
You also mentioned to me there's a quote from David O. McKay, who was a real champion of agency. He tells two stories to show how David O. McKay was a champion regardless of which side you came from. A couple of the more strident and staunch brethren, when Fawn Brody came out with their book, No Man Knows My History, who was David O. McKay's niece, they were on a crusade to get her excommunicated. And finally, David O. McKay said, leave her alone. And then at the same time, there was a lot of people that thought that Joseph Fielding Smith was a little too out there, a little too right of the right. And wanted to silence some of him, and he said, leave him alone. So David O. McKay was a champion of agency. You know, say what you want about him not getting rid of the priesthood ban to blacks. He was a champion of agency. So you said you had a quote?
Oh, next to the bestowal of life itself, the right to direct that life is God's greatest gift to man. That's the quote.
So what I like about you is that you truly respect it, because, you know, there's kind of a joke in Mormon expression that when the brethren say, exercise your agency, and a lot of times they'll say, exercise your agency unto righteousness, it's a euphemism for being obedient to their way. So there's only one real agency, and that's choosing their right. What I like about you and about David O. McKay is that you actually respect this principle that you hold as an eternal principle that even God is bound to, and allow your children that divine right in your mind to make our choices for our own lives. Would you say that's how you see it?
That's how I see it. Yes, I mean, I don't get me wrong. I pray for you guys all the time. Names in the temple, and you know the drill.
Of course, I prayed. Nearly daily. I wasn't so righteous as a Mormon to pray every day, but I prayed most days, and every prayer included softening Jimmy's heart, getting my sister to come back to the church. So I that's the thing that I would really like any believers that might be listening, that we know perfectly what it's like to be in your shoes. But it's impossible for you to know what it's like to be in our shoes. So just a dose of respect for our agency, our right to agency, you know, goes a long way.
Do you think it's fair to say that due to the events in your life, you have never operated under the assumption that life is simple or easy or that things play out in a perfect manner? Because it seems like you've had to deal with quite a bit of tragedy over your lifetime.
No, I think we're all given our share of challenges to overcome and so forth, and I've been given mine. And out of it, I've learned a lot, and the right people were there to support me.
Right. Well, where I was going with that is that I listening to your story, and comparing it to maybe other people who you know, other children of faithful parents, that child leaving the church might be the first real, you know, the first bad thing that's happened in that family.
Mm.
And so it just seems to me, listening to your story, that due to the experiences you've had in your life, I mean, yeah, this rocked the boat and these are horrible things you've had to deal with, but you, based on other experiences in your life, were kind of already equipped to deal with those sorts of things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very possibly. You know, losing your mom when you're in first grade suddenly, too, it was very sudden.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that, but again, there was always someone there to pick up the pieces, at least in the physical way, you know, the caring for us. But I miss my mom. I did.
Mm-hmm.
But you learn to adjust to it.
Right. And so since your son's leaving the church, your three of your children leaving the church, wasn't the first really catastrophic thing to happen in your life. You were
had
a little bit more perspective on it.
Perhaps. Mm-hmm.
The theology that you cling to, or not cling to, but that gives you hope that your children will return to the church. Do you believe that has to happen in this lifetime, or do you believe it could be an eternal process?
I would say that up until the end of the millennium.
End of the millennium. Okay.
That's just my own thought.
Mm-hmm. And do you spend any time thinking about what form that return will take? I've heard speculation, and I'm not trying to pin you down on anything. I'm just curious on your take that when those children come back, they haven't lived up, especially if those children have gone through the temple, they haven't lived up to the covenants they've made. So they'll kind of be like in your house, but not have houses of their own. Does that make sense?
I know what you're saying, but I honestly don't know.
You don't speculate?
No.
No?
No, I'm just hoping for the best.
Right. Well, there's nothing
wrong
with that.
And I honestly, I have given copies of that talk to more people. I bet you at least to 30 people.
Mm-hmm. Randy, but go ahead.
I've heard that some people kind of speculate a little more than you're willing to, Dad, that, you know, let's make a hypothetical here, that you stay true to your temple covenants. I don't ever accept the gospel in this life, but eventually the power of your temple covenants will be strong enough to have me come to that realization. I'll have to pay my penalty, as it says in that passage, but I really can't get to the highest level of the celestial kingdom that you and mom would enjoy. I would be more like along the lower level where you could visit me, but is that kind of how you see it?
That certainly is an option, and that's the way one of my good friends who has the same situation interpreted it. But I just want the best possible outcome that might be available. That's all I'm shooting for.
Does the best mean what would make Randy and your other children happy for eternity?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it.
Because if they don't, let's say they don't want, do you believe that that there's a chance they wouldn't want the highest kingdom of the celestial kingdom?
I suppose that's a possibility, but I sure don't. In fact, I've often wondered that myself, mm-hmm. as I'm thinking about how, what was that premortal, gathering like?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was there. I don't know. I really don't know. You're getting me into areas where I don't know, and right now I'm just going with hope.
Right. I think that we're pestering you with these questions because I find it fun to speculate on these types of things. But
like to take things to the logical conclusion.
Yeah.
that's how we're wired. Yeah. Heather and I are you know similarly minded. We don't always agree, but mm-hmm. We do definitely like to take things out to the rational end. But I know that's where believers like you, Dad, really use faith to take you the rest of the way.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that gives you peace and help in coping with the disappointment. Because make no mistake, I know that you're disappointed in my decisions and Jimmy's and our sister's decisions. But you don't let it affect our relationships. And that I love that about you. You mentioned that we don't like to debate, but you notice when you came out to visit, I do still ask you hard questions like
you needle.
I needle and then back off when I see your face is getting a little too pained, but you are willing to engage a little bit. What advice would you give to disaffected children? Obviously I'm talking about adult children, but on how to approach their parents when they want to let them know that they are struggling or don't believe anymore.
Oh boy. They've certainly got to know their parents and how they'd expect them to react. But you got to be forthright. I mean, that's you. I think I would have been hurt if I would have known that Jim and Heather were faking it for our, to keep it from us, but yet they weren't really living it. I would rather know what the truth is and then deal with the truth. And I can't say that would work in every situation because we're all so different. But that's how I would prefer it. And I'm glad you did it the way you did it. You were sensitive, but yet you were making your point. I just regret not seeing it, not seeing the signs, and they were there.
Well, let me ask you this question.
Sure.
Let's say mom never died of cancer, and I had to approach her about this. Would my approach have worked with mom?
No. You would have been wise to do it like your sister did when she got pregnant. She called me and told me the news, and your mom was sitting right next to me, and I was dying, but I couldn't say a word until I could assimilate it myself and deal with it and then go through the process. And then I told her and then ducked,
So I guess the take-home message from that would be, if you have two parents and they're both believers, start with the less emotional parent and have them help you reveal to the more emotional parent.
I that's the way I prefer. I'm glad it happened that way. I'm glad your sister, wanted to do it that way. And And then we kind of got it out of our systems, at least initially, and it worked. It worked very well for us.
Okay. Well, there is, before we finish with your final word, Dad, because I want to give you final word. One thing I would like to say, if there's any believers still listening this far in the podcast, there's two things that we as disaffected people don't want to hear. The first one is because inevitably you're going to ask, well, why? Why would you doubt? I mean, that would have been an absurd question to me 5 years ago. I even remember saying once, someone once told me, don't read the Journal of Discourses unless you're really firm in your testimony because it could shake you up. And I said to that person, oh, come on, there's nothing that can shake my testimony. You know, there's kind of that, and I think that's common in the church. You have this hubris about your testimony. But the one thing you don't want to do is just when they start bringing up issues about the church's history is just wave your hand and say, no, that's just anti-Mormon baloney. You know, why are you reading that anti-Mormon stuff? Because the fact of the matter is, you don't have to go outside of the Journal of Discourses or the History of the Church or the Journal of Joseph Smith or the, you know, the minutes of, you know, multiple historical meetings, including the Council of 50 and whatnot, that to find things that are very troubling to a lot of people when they come across this stuff. So they're not even coming across it from anti-Mormon sources. They're coming across it from church sources. The second thing is, and Heather was getting at this earlier about Jimmy, you know, maybe some assumptions you might have had, Dad, about Jimmy, was don't assume the only reason that we could have any difficulties with our testimony is because we want to sin or we are sinning and we need to find an excuse for it. That is patently insulting. It's utterly insulting. It's infuriating. And it doesn't help. It does not help it the situation at all. So if you could, I mean, does that seem like a fair couple of things, Dad, to put out there for the believing parent that's getting a reveal?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I never thought of it that way, but it makes perfect sense.
And let's face it, the church, I remember learning this in my, maybe even teaching this in church, that it was taught many times that the only way that you can get doubt is that sin is causing a crack in your veneer, your whole armor of God, and sin is allowing the doubt to creep in because Satan, with his cunningness, can exploit those weaknesses in your armor. So the church kind of presents that paradigm, and I don't think that's helpful. And I hope that a lot of people, a lot of these believing people, when they come across a loved one who is disaffected, will understand that there are other reasons besides sin to have doubt in the church. So Heather, do you have anything to say about that?
Well, listening to it, I just wonder if your dad, he says that he wishes he had seen the signs sooner. Did you try to talk Randy out of his disbelief? Do you still think that maybe if you could just spend time with him and open him up to spiritual experiences that he would have the spiritual confirmation that he needs to believe again?
No, I'm not that arrogant in my my approach and so forth. It's just that I wish I would have. I mean, you know, I'm on the side that believes in prayer and so forth. In the back of my mind, kind of half jokingly, if I don't reach Randy before I die, then when he dies and he sees me waiting for him, he'll know that it wasn't afterlife.
That's going to be your gotcha moment.
There you go, Brant. That's an inside joke. Sorry, Brant told me once that he can't wait for Jesus to return so he can rub it in the faces of all the atheists. But he does it with a good heart. He's a good person. Okay, so I want to finish with something I'm going to completely and unashamedly, is that a word? Steal from my good friend John DeLynn, who my dad has met, by the way. John DeLynn has spent the night at my dad's house. Last year, John was our guest for the USC Syracuse game, and it was a late game, and he spent the night at our house, at my dad's house. By the way, my dad loves John DeLynn. Thinks he's wonderful. John DeLynn loves my dad equally. In fact, my favorite quote when John visited Dad was that you said, "Wow, he's the guy that goes and picks up all the bodies on the ground that the church leaves behind that we kind of step around or over." do you remember saying that?
No, I don't remember that one. I said that. Well,
you said that, yeah. That's why you were so impressed with him, is his passion to try to help those who he feels are victims of the church that, you know, are suffering because some of the teachings, like homosexuals and disaffected people. At any rate, John DeLynn has this thing that he likes to end especially when he's talking to believers, called Pillars of Your Faith. And it's also done, I think John might have stolen that from Sunstone anyway. So Dad, would you, give us briefly the pillars of your faith?
The pillars of my faith. Virtually my whole testimony is based on the Book of Mormon. If the Book of Mormon is true, Joseph Smith is a prophet, the church is true. That's the way I look at it. So that's why when Joan and I were going to get married and some of our neighbors tried to talk her out of marrying a real Mormon, because she was already a Mormon, but he's a real Mormon. I'd been to the temple. They gave her a whole bunch of anti-Mormon literature, and I looked at it, and I thought, I better have answers. Therefore, I got involved with farms and learned a lot of their stuff that they have produced, published, and so forth on the Book of Mormon, answering the gotchas and showing the plausibility of the book and so forth. And I just love it. To me, it's all on the Book of Mormon, and I accept the rest. I don't understand it. I mean, you can throw a ton of questions at me, and I won't be able to answer them, but I accept them, and at some point in time, I will understand them. So it's really, to me, the Book of Mormon.
So it's one big foundation.
One big foundation. I mean, Joseph Smith didn't need the Book of Mormon to declare himself a prophet. And then what's his name? The Nibley, Hugh Nibley said, if you're going to make up scripture, make it short, make it vague, and keep it to yourself. Well, the Book of Mormon's anything but those. And it survived. I just love it. I just love that book. It's my foundation.
Excellent. Well, Heather, unless you have anything to add?
Nope.
I just want to thank you, Dad, for, as I call you, the DOD, dear old Dad. I want to thank you for putting yourself out there, because once this is once this posts, it's on the internet forever. And and it takes courage for you to do this. You're the first believing Mormon to be interviewed on this podcast.
Well, Brant was interviewed. He's the first believing parent of a disaffected.
Yeah. Brant doesn't count. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding, Brant. But Zilpha said that first. Yes, the first believing parent. I mean, because Brant has been exposed to the stuff and been a panelist on Mormon Expression. But my dad doesn't even know what Mormon Expression is, so. I just want to thank you for being willing to do this. I love you, Dad, and I value our relationship and friendship as one of the most important things in my life. And thank you, Heather, for hosting this and recording this,
of course,
for giving us a chance to share this story and message.
Of course. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
The host for today's episode of Mormon Expression Voices was Randy Snyder. Directing, producing, and editing was done by Heather C. And the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today. Leaps.